Welcome back to this English version of A la rencontre d'un inconnu. We are set to learn even more from the great performer, Sean Kempton. So, let's get back to it.
You have a few things that you are really proud of. One of them is performing at the Royal Albert Hall with your wife. How is it different to play with somebody that you have such a synchronicity with?
Yeah, it's amazing when you, especially what we do as well, because it's something that's such free, it can be such free flow, that you run out and the idea is really, the act is an excuse to get on stage, so ideally we get out and we just play. You watch any good sports team, that they know where the other person is without looking, so they'll flick the ball or kick or pass the ball or throw something, and they'll know that person's going to be there. Mm-hmm. So I know I can go any way. And I know that Michaela will always be there. And that came about because someone got injured, I think. We were in the Albert Hall. We were coming into the Albert Hall, and someone was injured. I think it was Colin. Colin Heath was one of the good clown parts, good Canadian, up your way. And then Michaela came in the last minute. So we toured her in an hour or 2 hours, the show. So it's okay, this is what it is. But we just knew intrinsically how to play. So we know each other as life partners, but on stage we played a lot as well. So, and I think what was really nice about that is it took us a long time to find our clown relationship, which is really important. Who's the master, who's the servant? You know, this thing. And for so long in the relationship with Michaela, I wanted to be the funny one. I wanted to be the stupid, the one who got all the games. Mm-hmm. And we would have endless moments where we would have arguments or I overrode her and played too much. So, and I would, in typical man-spreading world, I would suck the oxygen out of the stage. And because I'd been playing for a while and because I knew the show so well, it was the first time where I'd really gone, I'm going to step back and I'm going to let her play. And she's far funnier than me. There's not enough female clowns anyway out there, but she's far funnier and she went wild. And it was really nice just to go, oh, this is so easy. So, and the Royal Albert Hall being such a prestigious venue, having also not been back in the UK for the last 15 years, it was kind of that perfect kind of merging of, we're home, baby. Kind of running out and just going, let's add them. And it, that truly felt like letting two animals out of a cage. Every night, I think the artistic directors were nervous because they didn't know which way we'd go. Yeah, it was a privilege. It's a privilege. And we still play together. I think, we always have a tricky rehearsal process because we've all got so many ideas. But no matter how much journey we've gone in our rehearsal process, every time we hit stage, it's very easy. And we're just off. Yeah.
So it sounds really fun. I mean, it's rare that you can play with someone who has, you know, such a tight-knit feeling with, like you said earlier. If you know your partner is going to be where you expect him to be or her to be, and you just roll the ball where it needs to go, it's it just builds itself up to being something that really looks and performs incredibly, you know.
Yeah. And or even if you just enjoy the fail, and then you both play in the fail, which is again one of the big important things of a clown is you don't have to succeed. You can suck badly, and that's funny as well. So, I mean, often this would happen in a rev where, how do you throw the other person under the bus? Because that's funny. And then the game is, oh, I didn't expect that. Okay, I'm going. Because that's part of the tennis. You hit the ball to me, I'll hit it back. Mm-hmm. You don't hit a ball to me, there's no game. So it's this ping pong that's super important. So I think often, yeah, there's a pleasure playing with Michaela, which is we know each other so well, and we'll go like this, and we give each other space. And then with other clown partners, it's been, you just dumped me. Okay. I'm watching them with the glint in their eyes, knowing that they've just thrown me under the bus, going, get out of that one.
It looks absolutely fun to be able to participate in something that kind of jovial. I mean, it's the basic of it is to have fun, really. If you're not having fun, fail or success, you need to have fun. But I'm curious, since you've already started your solo show, and it's usually more like of a smaller crowd, if, let's say, money wasn't an issue, what would be the stage and what would be the show that you like to perform?
writing an arts grant at the moment. That's what money is always an issue, isn't it? Well, I think now where I'm at is it's more making. I mean, I have so my house is full of books everywhere because ideas every 2 seconds come out of my head, so I write them down. Mm. I've got pieces of paper and bits collected everywhere. So I'm now slowly in the process of setting up my own company to build work, to make work. Whether I'm in it or not, it doesn't matter. It's I've just got to make these pictures. I've been directing a lot for other people and inheriting cast or inheriting stories, and it's time for me to put that together. So if money was no object, I'd have someone fund me to kind of go, okay, well, let's make this first show. Let's build this first show, which is truly an ensemble that I can really look at all of that theatre clown experience and put it on bodies, on equipment. And I like to look at what's in the real world and see how we can mess around with those things in terms of equipment as well. So we're on the process of that. I'm going to do a cheap version first to see then we can get to the money no object bit. I do get very I think there's a trouble with circus in Britain is because funding is so tight. Mm. Often what happens is you're making a show in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, which if you're trying to make a show of any depth or quality, it's impossible because you have this double thing with circus where obviously you have to train the skill, develop the skill, but if you want to layer on this emotional connection story, that's another thing. So you know, that, whereas in Europe, a lot of times we're competing with companies that have had 5 months rehearsals, 6 months rehearsals. Mm. So we come in with our tin pot 2 week on £30 show. We can never get it. So the aim at the moment is I'm trying to have a slow burn where I do a development this year, bigger development next year, and then in 3 years' time the first show comes out.
So it's a long process. It's a long process, but it will be a show of good quality when it comes out.
That's the aim. That there's a proper depth, and I can truly get the picture I want out there.
Mm. And on that subject, how do you come up with new material? You just, like you said, come up with something and you just write it down, and at the end of the day, you just compile everything?
Yeah, I've got so my head is, I'm a terrible insomniac as well. My head just keeps going and endlessly drips. So I have to be careful sometimes. I need to move all the time, so often I'll go for a run and I'll be out for 2 hours and I'll come back and I've written a whole new show. I often have to leave myself alone. In Las Vegas, I would have this thing where I go, I've got an idea, I can't go to sleep. Okay, so right, well, I'm going to make sure I have a pen and paper beside my bed, right? And for a few weeks, that would work, I'd write the ideas down. But then I'm like, oh, I'm still awake. Oh, I'll tell you what, I'll just go downstairs and I'll research it a little bit. Okay, now I can't go to sleep. Now, so by the end of 2 months, I was staying up all night and I'd have a full show the next day. I find it really interesting, the idea of creativity, where ideas come from.
Mm-hmm.
There was a really good, actually, I think it's called The Chef's Table, I think, on Netflix, where they look at famous chefs and where their ideas have come from and how they've had their journey and exploration of ideas and process. For them, it's exactly the same way. It could be one guy made an amazing dish from pigeon shit under a bridge. Because I like the energy of that, the structure. That reminds me of the texture of egg. And he builds it from this. Often with the students, we do things like just look around the room, find something. It might be a scratch. There might be a nail sticking out the wall, and just really have a think about that, what that is. And they'll start looking. You'll start looking at the energy, the rhythm, the texture of it, and then you go, what does that mean? And you start digging deeper, going, ah. So I when I'm creating work, I'll have a 5 or 6 stage thing, which is one which is preparation. So because my head is chaotic and I'm coming up with ideas all the time, it's good to kind of quickly lock down on a theme. So okay, I'll go, okay, well, sand, right? As soon as you put this out to the universe, suddenly all you hear and see from everybody is sand.
Yeah.
It's like as soon as you lock onto something. So the preparation would be doing a lot of research. So everything I can think of that is about that, music, paintings, books, newspaper articles, emotional connections I have with that, so I just put everything down there. I also do preparation in terms of, well, okay, what, how does equipment work in that way? How can I adapt that? Then you get into rehearsal rooms, so you get into the creation phase, and that first week, would be what I call throwing mud at the wall. So we just make unconnected images that are not trying to lock down a show. So mm-hmm. I want to research this. Great, we're going to go and explore that, but then we're not going to make it beholden to the show. That's just an unconnected thing. Now we're going to rehearse something about sand crystal. Now we're going to rehearse something about, you know, discovering Australia. So, and only then you start seeing these red lines. You go, oh, actually, these things are in the same family. So if I'm going to move those a bit like Minority Report, move these bits over here and these bits over here. So you start putting little atoms, idea atoms together. It's where you get into the formation. So you start formating the show. See, I can't speak English. and then you have this structure that then you can start to tweak. You perform the show and then you reflect on it. But for me, that ideas are everywhere. That there's. I always talk about having an open flow or having your ears open, your antennas open. And if you open your eyes, you could make anything out of everything. Out of the people, out of the lights that is there. Well, there's a game. There's a game in everything, mm-hmm. which is where it comes back to the save the show. That I run out, I have nothing. I look in the room, there's 1,000 ideas. Great, I'll take that one. So you just have to be open. And there was a famous writer who was saying that they used to look out the window and they could feel an idea coming, and they could feel it coming through the cornfields. So they just had to grab it while it was there, boof, and put it down and write it down. So you think of this sort of weird, it's a bit like having the key in martial arts. You know, there's, if this energy spinning mm-hmm. around you, it's an infinite source. You just have to be open to it and not kind of block. Wow, that was a big long answer and lots of words.
Well, there's a lot of. I'm gonna have to rewatch this because there was a lot of information. But at the essence, there's a few steps that are still practicable. Practicable?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. There's a trick I've learned from Tim Ferriss, which is similar to what you said. It's you throw mud, you brainstorm, you get one word, you just spit out everything you're thinking about, and you just practice this thing. So you try to make a list of about 20 things that, let's say again, sand brings you. So you're gonna think, well, insects, desert, and etc. And you just fill that blank space with all these words, and then you start to add these words together. Like as you said it with a lot more words, but at the end of the day, it's still you find the essence, you compile the essence, and from there you start to create something new. So there's a lot of context that needs to go within the story, especially if you want to go on your show stuff, you want it to go about more about love, but still the essence of the show is about love, but everything that could be added to it could come from anything else.
Yeah. So there. And it's interesting. There's different ways of. So you can poach from everywhere. I can't remember offhand what they all are, but if I look at factories and how they look at components. So if I'm looking at acrobatic thing, there's 5 stages within the factory when they re-look at something. So they go, well, what if I take an essential component out of this, what happens? Mm-hmm. So if I take an essential moment out of handstands, which is a solid ground, what happens to the handstander? It's slidey floor. So how do they do that? Or if I take its use and give it another use, how does that work? You know, so these, you kind of, how you flip and challenge yourself to put yourself in trouble to kind of find a new way of looking at something.
There's so much to explore within these, like the way you explain it, you're just tearing down the walls and you just say, you can take that and that and make something completely new. And if you start to create things from nothing and add them up and create again something new, the quantity of things you can create is infinite. You know, it's amazing. So you can go really, really far with pretty much nothing. But at the end of the day, it's still practice. You need to be, like you said, you're able to make, well, yeah, kind of make a show of 40, 45 minutes with basically no information, except when you're going out and like let's say, well, it's slippery. If there's water, it's slippery. And now you just fall and chain goes on and on and on. And you just create 40 minutes of content, starting by a simple single point, which is still really amazing. There's a lot of different acts that come within the circus. And one thing that I've noticed when I was in Montreal, it was under a chapiteau, which is the style of the chapiteau. There is, let's say, like if you go to Las Vegas, which is really grander than what happens in chapiteau, what kind of sets it apart within the acts you make? Do you have to be louder in a, like, let's say, a crowd of 5,000 rather than with a crowd of a few thousands? How do you change your exposure?
It's funny. Yeah, it's more about dilating your energy more than it is being louder or physically louder.
Mm.
So I'm aware if I run out to 10,000 people that I have to push my energy out. And it doesn't mean that I have to do more. And it doesn't mean that I have to be more energetic. It just means that I am sending my ripples, my physical echoes out further. There is a practical thing, which is that actually the people further back will receive information later. So you have to make sure there's a physical clarity. You know, so sharpness and precision and decision is really important for large-scale crowds, just because you'll feel a difference of reaction time as opposed to a smaller crowd. I can't just quit flipping and deviating too quickly, I think. It's an interesting one because it depends on the venue, because you can have a 5,000 seater that feels really intimate. Or you know, sometimes we're playing in these ice rinks where, you know, those 500 people are so far away. That's where you need the physical clarity, because they're not going to see your face. They're not going to get your energy. So they have to read those physical silhouettes. But if it's more intimate, I could just raise my finger. But as long as I send my energy to that, they'll get it. As long as the intention is right. They know a slow burn is a slow burn. So they know that audience member is in trouble if I slowly look at them. It doesn't matter whether it's 10,000 people or one person. They know that person's in the shit.
I get it. It's good to see. Actually, we're still going back to the nonverbals, because people farther will not be able to sense every little detail, but will be able to understand the big picture of what's happening. And at the end of the day, that's what they need to know to be able to understand what is happening. You have worked, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think you started working at the Cirque du Soleil in Santa Monica, is that right?
With Soleil, yeah. Yeah, I was previously with Dragon, because I was doing Le Rev, and I just had left. I think it was a mistake on their part. It was great for me. I just left Le Rev, and I'd moved to Australia, because my wife is Australian. And I guess there was an injury or a clown left in Santa Monica. So they were like, we need someone to come in really quickly. And Jimmy Slonina, who's an amazing clown, I have a clown crush on Jimmy, but I was with him in Las Vegas for a long time, and they were like, Sean, it'd be great. It'd be a quick shorthand because they know how to play each other. So they said, come to Santa Monica. I was like, great. That was great. That was only 2 weeks out of work. So I flew to Santa Monica, and they were like, hang on a minute, you're English. I went, yeah, well, we thought you were American. They didn't have a work visa. So there was a lot of, but I'd already signed a contract, so there was a lot of panicking because they suddenly had to get an American visa for me very quick. But yeah, I mean, that was a pretty epic thing because, I mean, I'm a surfer, I grew up surfing, so I had, at the time, they'd given me an apartment right on the beach, right by the Santa Monica Pier. So yeah, I get up in the morning, I would go surfing, and then the evening I get to play with a friend in a beautiful show. It was kind of the ultimate performing experience, really, for me.
That's a pretty sweet deal. I mean, being on the on the side of the beach, doing what you love day in, day out, because you start with the surf and you end with the shows. I mean, it doesn't really get better than that. Do you have a chance to surf somewhere near London?
No, I grew up, again, I'm from the southwest of England, so we have waves in Devon and Cornwall. We have waves, and then obviously Wales and Scotland and Ireland, and I would travel down to Europe. But most of the time, I'm touring, so I get to spend a lot of time surfing on my own in new breaks around the world. So it's a big advantage with these big shows, as I've surfed most places around the world. But always, it's kind of funny because you're never in your home break, and you're always kind of, again, it's that forging relationships, because there's a dynamic in a lineup, which is where people sit beyond the waves, that with locals, and you kind of have to feel it out. You have to give them space, you know, because it's their break. You can't just take every waves, and you have to, I guess, earn your dues. So I spent the last probably 25 years of my surfing time mostly being polite to people in the ocean so I can catch a wave. But they usually laugh when they find out I'm English, because they're like, ah, no English, sir. But yeah, there are a few of us.
Well, from what I've been able to see, you really have a connection with the ocean. Where does this come from?
I grew up by the ocean. Yeah, I grew up by the sea. So in North Devon, we have beautiful, beautiful, long, sandy coastlines, and also really good cliff reef breaks. So yeah, I was always in the sea. And it's one of, you probably can tell by this podcast, that I don't relax. often this was when I submerge myself and get beaten up by the ocean. It's a really good way of clearing my head and settling, and I find it just really calming and beautiful. Yeah, so whenever I can get towards the sea, I'm drawn to it. It's just how I've grown up.
Did it ever happen to have a circus act on a vessel, on a cruise ship?
I never did it. No, I never did it. I mean, I know it's a really good earner for a lot of circus performers in the UK. They do cruise ships because now every cruise ship has cabaret shows. They have their own shows. They always employ acrobats. More and more, they're making whole circus shows for the ships. It used to be that you would come in and be the one Tishbore rope artist. But now, yeah, I know Cirque du Soleil have shows. Another company from Australia, called Strut and Fret, they have shows on these boats. It's never really my thing, you know. I just, in a way, I'd be the same. If I was on the boat, I'd be the same as being landbound. You can't get onto the waves.
Yeah.
And I think by the time I was doing circus, I was more into making and building shows with the company I had rather than being in other people's shows. And then I went on to the bigger shows. So I kind of missed that kind of cruise ship thing, but I know it's a good earner, and it certainly keeps a lot of us afloat, that's for sure. That's a really bad pun.
That's a great pun. It's a great pun.
It's just stick to mime.
Oh well, I'm a fan of puns, so usually when the conversation slows down and I just find a funny word, I just usually use it to break the conversation and make everybody laugh. I'm a huge fan of puns, but. Going back to teaching, you have the chance to be able to teach the new generations of, in your case, acrobats. But if you were to teach clowns, what would be kind of the first lesson you'd like to teach them?
Look, straight away, and it's the same as I do with acrobats, is I want to know who they are. So I want them to be really simple and honest, because often what happens is people come on and they project all of this stuff that they want you to see. I'm really funny, or I'm really nervous, or they're trying to recreate what they've seen someone else do, or they're trying to be a good student for a certain teacher, so because that particular clown teacher has shown that that's how you play. But what is really nice about clown and circus is it's really about the personality and the reflection of that person. So if they can stand on their own and breathe, and I see them, then it's going to be way more charming, really funny, they're going to be more open and receptive to anything because they've cut down all the walls.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of the hardest things to do, to be, because we have puts, we, because since we're a kid, we look, don't do that, don't this, or you look like this, you should be like that. So we're always putting these doors mm-hmm. up. But yeah, definitely, I want to see where the superhero is, you know, where the kook is, and know that actually, often, what is most ridiculous about them is the thing they're trying to hide, because they think it's an oddity, it doesn't conform, but that's what's really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. The fact that I'm kind of spiky, erratic, and energetic, that's my superpower, you know, that's really useful, that I kind of make weird connections in my world, in my work world, it's brilliant. In the normal world, it's like, man, he's seriously odd. That's gorgeous, you know. But, you know, really often the first exercise I do is like, okay, you know, I talk about kind of rhythms, get a very fast inner rhythm, like a hunted animal. So mm-hmm. you have this, you're about to jump off a cliff, or because often in circus, you know, if you're spotting when someone's doing anything acrobatic, you have to be on the edge anyway. And when I clap your hands, fall down. And just by the act of falling down, I pretty much can read who everyone is, just by how they fall, how they control themselves, don't control themselves. And that pretty much straight away goes, ah, that's their game, that's their game, that's game. And then we find the rest of the workshop will be me unpicking that. And getting them to trust that that's gorgeous and it's fine. You don't need all this other tricks. You don't need, again, it's a life thing, isn't it? Same as anyone in life. You don't need to project any of this because you're infinitely more interesting as a human being than all the nonsense that you're putting, you know, in front of you.
But like you say, a lot of people put things before them as a barrier, but yep. A lot of people put that in order to have confidence because they believe that their shield will hold up to criticism and all the other shit that can be bound to you. How can you be so confident without any of that protection?
You just need to know that you're in terms of clown or something, you just need to know it's fine to fail. And that's really hard to do. That actually, and I've only learned it by failing so much that now I know I can rescue myself. But there is nothing wrong with failing. There's if you come on and you suck, it's funny. Nothing's going to happen to you. If you don't do something right at work, oh my God, what's the worst they're going to do? If they fire you, that's fine. You can go somewhere else. It's nothing. The only times I have succeeded or developed or evolved is through failure. That's absolutely, I was talking to this with my wife the other day, the shows that often have been the hardest, the ones I've learned most from and I've evolved most from, you know, the moments of failure, the drop points are where I've advanced and gone. So, and if you fail, it's just data collection. Ah, okay, great, I failed. Why? Because of this. Great, next time I'll do this. Next time I'll do this. So it's data collection, collect. But as a caveat, you know, failing as a clown is horrible. And I've walked away, even recently walked away and gone, I'm not performing it too much. because I'm being exactly that, I'm being very open. And it's different with an actor where if your show sucks, you can feel, oh, this feels hard, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. As opposed to if I go out there, they don't like me. You know, then there's a key difference. You've got 500,000 people not liking you personally as opposed to the work you're doing. That takes a little bit of getting used to. But it's just trusting who you are, trusting what you want to say, and yeah, enjoy the fail, enjoy the drop.
So yeah, you need to work hard with failing to be able to enjoy failing at least, because your safety net is your reassurance that if you fail, you will still be able to advance in the comedy, in the show, in the performance of the act. So it seems a lot like a trust fall, where people will put their hands behind you and say, trust us, even if you fall, we will be able to catch you. Whether the difference is the floor will catch you and people will laugh and that will be saved with that failure. So,
but and if they don't laugh, that's fine as well.
Mm.
That's the other thing, is they don't laugh, you then have attention. that is great for comedy or great for, and it's not always about the laugh, it's great for the audience feeling anxious and nervous, or because then you can go with this. But it's interesting because, you know, there's lots of, you know, having come from acting before that, which is a really tricky world, which is about you're being rejected most of the time. So you have that sense of failure all the time. You go in a room, someone's staring at you, you don't hear back from them. You know, it's a very hard one to kind of find to rebuild. But I think in general, for everyone to understand that, you know, what are the degrees of failure?
Mm-hmm.
And what is it really going to do to you to not take a risk? You know, to not take that risk. Not so much of my advancement, the only reason I've got to where I am now is by stepping off the cliff. And I think we've all had those moments where where you've had an opportunity, or where you've had a pathway, and you've gone, I'm not, you know, you feel that it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
If I go here, if I follow that, that means everything before me has changed.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you step off that cliff, everything before you is the same, and,
mm-hmm.
and you have to take those risks, and they're scary, and often they're quite significant risks. So I guess that's a case of, and if the risk doesn't take off, there'll be another opportunity.
Mm.
There's always something. But yeah, dare to jump off the cliff. This is metaphorical, people who are listening. I don't want a lot of Canadian lemmings making their way to
Well, at least there's a sport performed by Red Bull, which is cliff diving. It is kind of safe.
Yeah.
You need practice, but it's still kind of safe. So if you want to jump off a cliff, there is protection that can be made and practice that can be used. So the people will be safe.
So
they have options to be safe.
We will put links at the end of this podcast for anyone who wants to safely jump.
Yeah, we could do that. There's a few good Red Bull videos that people could use. From what you spoke, you mentioned two things from three quotes that you've passed earlier in the pre-interview. One is jump off a cliff, because you take the risk of having either fail or success, but at least you take the risk to know what will happen. And I believe that is a core principle that can be used throughout life, because people often think the negativity that will come out from trying something will be greater than trying it and failing. And for the most part, it's the opposite, because if you don't do it, there's 0% chance you're going to succeed in something. And the failure is automatic. Whether you try a new career or you try a new passion or pretty much anything you want to try, except if you want to really cliff dive and there's rocks below, you need a kind of logic. But at the end of the day, if you're able to be precise in what you want to accomplish and have the goals where you want them to be, you can pretty much accomplish what you want. And taking the risk is part of everything about that. And the other thing you mentioned earlier was you had to be really nice to surfers, which kind of reminds me of kill them with love. And it's not kill them with love. How did you say it?
Kill them with kindness.
Kill them with kindness. Kill them with love.
Well, I just want to say, because I think it's when I looked up that phrase, I think I read it down to you. And I've always said kill them with kindness, because that's how I deal with you always come across bullies, or there's always certain people you come across, like, well, I'm just going to reinvest mm-hmm. the niceness to you. But when I looked up the phrase, it was like, oh, yeah, it came from monkeys, or something originally came from monkeys, where they love their infant so much they would hug it to death. So I was like, oh, maybe that's a different approach to what I was imagining. So now I'm just going to really hug people hard. That's the wrestler. You could try that as well.
Would you like to talk about the third one you mentioned?
Oh, yeah. No, the time of it's funny. So the third one, which is, I guess, the other two were life mantras. This one, time and tide waits for no man, which I've always said, because it was mostly came from trying to get friends up because they're still in bed when we're trying to go surfing, and the idea that the ocean works in certain ways, so when the tide is at a certain point, the wave is going to be breaking. So I'm like, come on, just get out of bed so we could. But it's also kind of really interesting that it will just keep moving on, you know. It just keeps, I guess, the world is there and it'll keep moving. I don't really have much philosophy about that.
Well, it still goes far because time doesn't wait for people either. The same way that the water won't wait for the surface to come out. If you are bound to do something and you really want to accomplish something, you need to do it when you can, not wait for the good time, because the good time will never arrive. You need to make the good time happen. And I took the time to especially read when I ask somebody for a quote, usually there's a lot of depth in the reason why they gave it. And the essential things I can see about the quotes that you have given me are about how you can perform continuously in life. You take the risk, you take it when you need to take it, and you be kind to everybody. So, I mean, there's not really a better life mantra than that compilation of quotes. I mean,
and that's why I asked you onto my podcast, so I could get this clever insight from you. It's true. No, yeah, it is. It's about reinvesting. You're right.
Well, you're right, because it's your quote. I'm just giving you what I found about your quote. I think that pretty much sums up my question board. I think we've pretty much traveled through everything I've searched about you.
For a mime, I talk a lot.
Yeah, you do talk a lot for a mime, but I'd be even more impressed that you would be able to speak at the quality you speak without speaking.
That silence was me speaking.
Yeah, I understood it. So, we're going to end with this. So, I'm very grateful to have you again on this show today. It's been an honor to be able to learn even more from you. And I believe there is still a lot more to learn about you. And maybe in the future, we'll have a chance to get a cup of coffee somewhere near the sea, because I know you really enjoy it. And maybe if I get the chance to learn to be a clown and even maybe to surf from you, I'd voluntarily be able to look like a fool so you can have fun and maybe laugh at me as well.
Well, you know, there are waves in Montreal.
There is, but I don't really trust the fleuve, so... So, before we end, is there something that you would like to end to close the show?
I don't. Other than it was a real pleasure talking to you, and I really like this, that you're exactly the same thing. You're like, I'm going to do a podcast. I'm going to do a podcast to step off the cliff in my car at -40 degrees.
Well, yeah, it's cold, but at least talking gets me moving.
So, like, for the listeners, keep listening to this podcast. And thank you so much for having me on. It's really nice to really rattle on for a long period of time. I will be doing this in French for you, obviously, for...
what a tease.
I wish it's so important for me that it was really good that I was able to be in Quebec and speak French so much when I was there. Now I'm in England, just to be up to speed, it's difficult, but I recognize how important it is. So I apologize, I'm not speaking French, but it's less pretty than you can imagine. But thank you for listening, guys. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you again for being here. So thank you again. Thanks to everybody. Thanks to the audience. And continue to be daring, to be curious.
So this is it for the second part of this podcast. Thanks again for all the viewers. And thanks again to Sean Kempton for being part of this episode. Don't forget to follow for new episodes. And if you want some exclusive content, please join my Patreon. Thank you and continue to be curious.